This lecture is produced by Stone Kingdom Ministries of Asheville, North Carolina. Follow along in your Bible as James Brueggemann shares good news from God's Word. For a sample copy of our publication and a catalog of the resources available, write to Stone Kingdom Ministries, Post Office Box 5695, Asheville, North Carolina, zip code 28813. You may also visit us on the web at www.stonekingdom.org. Your regular financial support is what makes this ministry possible, and we are grateful to you for that. And now, here is Bible teacher James Brueggemann.
Turn to 1 Samuel chapter 29 and keep your bookmark there. Our two messages today are part of our continuing studies in the life of Saul and David. For the sake of any new people on the tape ministry, I want to give just a couple of brief statements of introduction. First, although we've been going serially through the book of 1 Samuel, beginning with the coronation of Saul as Israel's first king, this is not the type of series of messages where you need to have heard all the previous messages in order to understand today's message, because these are not doctrinal studies per se, but rather they're studies of the lives of Israel's first two kings. We're comparing and contrasting their lives. We're paying special attention to the character qualities because these men are types and shadows of two kinds of believers. Saul symbolizes believers who are not overcomers, while David represents the believers who seek to attain the high calling of overcomership. And since we all want to be overcomers, it behooves us to see what it is that makes one an overcomer. In our last study, entitled Saul Comes to the End Door, we discussed the issue of witchcraft in the church. The title of today's two-part message is Witchcraft and the Amalekites, and we won't actually get to that particular portion of it until into the second message today, but that's the title. Now, in that previous message, we observed how Saul had sunk so low in his rebellion against God that when Saul sees the Philistine armies amassing on yonder hill, he is desperate for trying to get some kind of higher guidance on what he should do. His mentor, the prophet Samuel, is dead by this time, and when Saul tries to get a hold of Yahweh, Saul either gets a busy signal or no answer. The father didn't even leave the voicemail on for him. So Saul concludes that God is ignoring him. So Saul then consults the witch of Endor, and through this forbidden practice of necromancy, God nonetheless uses it to inform Saul that on the morrow, he and three of his sons will die in the battle with the Philistines, and Israel will lose. Israel will be defeated. Meanwhile, and ironically, David and his army of 600 men and their families have been living under the protection of Achish, king of Gath, of the Philistines. In other words, David is living under the protection of the enemies of Israel. After having experienced Saul trying to kill him on numerous occasions, David finally got tired of it and simply sought asylum among the Philistines. After living next door to the king in the city of Gath for a while, David really gets tired of that, and so he requested of Achish to have a place in the country. So Achish gives David and his retinue the deserted city of Ziklag. Now, although this is many years after David had killed the Philistine giant Goliath, there were still many Philistines who remembered David, and they did not have the trust in him that their king Achish did. So as we begin to read now in chapter 29 of 1 Samuel, the Philistines are preparing to attack Israel. And this is going to present quite a predicament for David, because he and his men are right there with the Philistines in that encampment. The battle will soon be joined. Of course, the women and children of David's army had been left behind in Ziklag. Verse 1, now the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, and the Israelites pitched by a fountain which is in Jezreel. There are two cities, at least, called Aphek. In fact, some Bible dictionaries say there may have been as many as four or five different locations in Israel called Aphek. And I got these Bible maps here, and I have to tell you, after looking at them for a while, they are just general approximations. They are not really that exact, but for our purposes in a big room like this, it'll work out fine. This is Israel during the time of the 12 tribes, when it was split up into states, you could say, actually tribal territories. The Philistine territory is down here along the Mediterranean coast, and where they went was they marched all the way up here, David with the Philistines, that was too high, up here to the territory of Issachar. This little thing there says Jezreel. It shows Aphek way up here, but that's not the one where they went. The other Aphek was right here by this Jezreel, doesn't show on the map. And remember, there was a range of mountains here. Mount Gilboa was right here. Endor is right there, and there's this great big valley between them. So that's the general location of this particular incident. That enormous wide valley between the Philistines and Israel is called by several names. It's called the Plain of Esdraelon. It's called the Valley of Jezreel. And most famously today, the Valley of Megiddo, which is where the fundamentalist prophecy preachers believe the so-called Battle of Armageddon is going to take place. You see, Armageddon is simply an anglicized form of the Hebrew Har Megiddo. Did you have a question?
I was going to ask today, with all of the attention that's going on over there, is that Lebanon, or is that still Israel, or where? What?
This is still Israel. This is the Golan Heights right up here. This is the Jordan River running there between, this is the Sea of Galilee at the time of Christ, Dead Sea, and between them runs the Jordan River. And the West Bank that you hear a lot about, that's the West Bank of the Jordan River. It's a territory about like this that the Palestinians are in, and of course, over here. And then the Gaza Strip is down here where it says Gaza. Verse 2, and the lords of the Philistines passed on by hundreds and by thousands, but David and his men passed on in the rearward with Achish. If you recall, Achish had taken a personal liking to David so much, and he trusted him so much, that he was going to make David, and in fact by this time he did, that's why he's back in the rearward with Achish the king, he made them his personal secret service detachment. They were in charge of the security of the king. Now isn't, you got to be pretty trusted for to make an enemy people your personal bodyguard. Then said the princes of the Philistines, what are these Hebrews here? And Achish said unto the princes of the Philistines, is not this David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, which hath been with me these days or these years? And I have found no fault in him since he fell unto me unto this day. This word fell, in this context, would probably have been better translated deserted. Because from a military perspective, David could have been considered a deserter. He was one of the generals of Saul's armies, wasn't he? And now he's gone over to the enemy from Saul's perspective. The Hebrew word there is nafal, and to desert is one of its many definitions. And so it means to fall. Isn't it interesting how it sounds like the Hebrew? Nafal, to fall.
New King James says defected.
Defected? Okay, they caught that. Verse 4. And the princes of the Philistines were wroth with him, and the princes of the Philistines said unto him, make this fellow return, that he may go again to his place which thou hast appointed him, and let him not go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he be an adversary to us. For wherewith should he reconcile himself unto his master? Should it not be with the heads of these men? Is not this David, of whom they sang one to another in dances, saying, Saul slew his thousands, David slew his 10,000s, remember that? The princes of the Philistines were wroth. They were angry. Fortunately, they apparently had not yet heard of David's destruction of the villages of the Geshurites and the Gezrites and Amalekites that we discussed in a prior message. Because if they had heard of it, they certainly would not have been so light on him. I mean, they probably would have locked him up as POWs. for the duration. But what we're seeing here is God's providential protection for David and his men, even while they must, for a time, live among their own nation's enemies. And we see that providence played out magnificently here as David, up to this point, was facing a very difficult dilemma. Either he would actually have to go out and fight against his own king and countrymen, or he would have to betray Achish, the man who was more than kind to David and his men. This latter scenario is exactly what the lords of the Philistines feared the most. They demanded that David be sent back to Ziklag, far from the scene of the forthcoming battle. The lords had said in verse 4, "For wherewith should he reconcile himself unto his master? Should it not be with the heads of these men?" In other words, they're saying, "Look, Achish, what better way for David to get back into the good graces of Saul than to take the heads off of our men and go back and carry the heads like he did with Goliath and say, 'Hey, look, Saul, what I did. Here's the heads of the Philistines. Let me back in now. Let's be buddies.'" That's what they're fearful of. And just before that, in verse 4, notice they are afraid that David will be an adversary to them. Guess what the Hebrew word for adversary is there? Satan, Satan in Hebrew. Satan. David will be Satan to them. "Then Achish called David," we're in verse 6, "and said unto him, 'Surely,'" this is Achish talking, "'surely as Yahweh liveth, thou hast been upright, and thy going out and thy coming in with me in the host is good in my sight, for I have not found evil in thee since the day of thy coming unto me unto this day. Nevertheless, the Lord's favor thee not.'" This is most amazing. Not only in how God is orchestrating the events here, but the fact that the Philistine king is swearing by the name of Yahweh. Has any Philistine ever swore by the name of Yahweh? Now, one might suspect that during the course of his sojourn in Gath, that David might have, quote-unquote, shared the gospel with old Achish. He might have told him many important truths. He might have told Achish about the mighty deeds of Yahweh on behalf of Israel in the Exodus and later on. And remember, at this point in history, it's about 400 years now since the Exodus, which is a stretch of time almost as much as the pilgrims coming to Plymouth Rock until now. And if David, in his instructing Achish, if he got around to telling him about how God would bless them for obedience and curse them for disobedience, well, if old Achish had any sense in his head whatsoever, he would have figured out that Israel is going to be vulnerable at this time because old Saul is very much in disobedience. So Achish could be very confident that they would win the battle. But like his lords and barons, Achish himself was quite ignorant also of David's military slaughters of the Gezrites, the Geshurites, and the Amalekites. Otherwise, he would not have spoken of David in these glowing accolades, saying that he hadn't found any evil in David. Looks to me like David's father, and I don't mean Jesse, has been at work again, clogging up the phone lines from Amalek to Philistia so that Achish is still in the dark about David's military forays into the southlands where Arabia borders Judah. And for those of you that weren't here last time, we discussed David going down. Was Ziklag on there? Ziklag is right in here somewhere. And David went south to the border of Arabia and went and killed every Geshurite, Gezrite, and Amalekite in that area. And then when he got back to Achish, he says, "Where you been?" And he says, "I've been out killing Israelites in the south of Judah." It's clear that Achish did not have absolute authority among the Philistines, but he had some kind of checks and balances system with his lords. And in this case, it appears that he was obligated to accede to their wishes. We've seen Achish identified as the king of Gath, but not as the king of the Philistines. It may have been that these lords were the chiefs of some of the lesser cities and other areas of the Philistines, and that they joined in this expedition against Israel, but they didn't give up their autonomy. Perhaps in the same way that the United States goes to war and Britain and Canada and France, etc., join in with us, but they don't give up their sovereign rights in doing so. Now, of course, someone's going to point out, well, what about the UN and NATO and all, you know? I know all that. This is just an illustration. In any event, Achish continues speaking to David, disappointed that David will not be able to accompany him to battle against Saul. Verse 7. Wherefore now return and go in peace, that thou displease not the lords of the Philistines. Can't you just picture David here acting his part to the hilt, looking sad and sympathetic to the feelings of Achish, and now feigning a bit of indignation as though he's really crushed and hurt that the dukes and the barons don't trust him? 8. And David said unto Achish, but what have I done? And what hast thou found in thy servant so long as I have been with thee unto this day, that I may not go fight against the enemies of my lord the king? He's really putting it on thick, isn't he? In fact, David was practically forced by circumstances to put on this charade. Had he not done so, it might have appeared to Achish that David was really not as loyal to him as Achish thought he was. And so for the sake of his own safety, and of course that of his 600 men, David played a variation of the old Brer Rabbit trick. Please don't throw me in the briar patch. Please don't make me go back to Ziklag. I want to go fight Saul. But God in his providence for David continued to keep Achish blind to the true situation. Verse 9. And Achish answered and said to David, I know that thou art good in my sight as an angel of God. Really got him schnookered, doesn't he? Notwithstanding, the princes of the Philistines have said, he shall not go up with us to the battle. Wherefore now, rise up early in the morning with thy master's servants that are come with thee, and as soon as ye be up early in the morning and have light, depart. This is an interesting phrase, thy master's servants, that Achish now speaks to David. There's a couple of possibilities here. First, since David has placed himself under the protection of Achish, then in that sense, Achish is David's master. But it would seem strange that after over a year of David's being in company with Achish, that Achish would still call David and his men his servants. One would think the formality of Achish making the point of who's the boss would have been settled by this time. You know, David, if he valued his life, never would have disagreed as to his status as the servant of Achish. So it seems far-fetched that Achish is referring to himself as the master. Turn to 1 Chronicles 12. Keep your bookmark here. 1 Chronicles 12, because the other possibility is revealed over there. This particular chapter, 1 Chronicles 12, relates how David accumulated his 600 men and many more as time went on. And there's one little passage in this chapter that relates directly to this time. While you're turning there, I'll point out over here on the map the territory of Manasseh. Manasseh was one of the biggest tribes. That's why they got two states or two territories, Manasseh east of Jordan and Manasseh west of Jordan over here. And it says in 1 Chronicles 12, 19, and there fell some of Manasseh to David when he came with the Philistines against Saul to battle. Here's that word fell once again. And again, it would have been translated better as deserted. So military commanders and probably some of their soldiers from the tribe of Manasseh were deserting Saul and joining David, continuing in that verse. But they helped them not. In other words, they helped the Philistines not. For the lords of the Philistines, upon advisement, sent him away, saying, he will fall to his master Saul to the jeopardy of our heads. As he went to Ziklag, there fell to him of Manasseh Adnah and Jozabad and Jediel and Michael and Jozabad and Elihu and Zilthai, captains of thousands that were of Manasseh. And they helped David against the band of the rovers, for they were all mighty men of valor and were captains in the host. For at that time, day by day, there came to David to help him until it was a great host, like the host of God. Turn back to 1 Samuel now. So I would suggest that Achish's reference to thy master's servants is Achish referring to Saul as the master, and these were Saul's servants from Manasseh who were deserting over to David at this time. Verse 11, so David and his men rose up early to depart in the morning to return into the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to Jezreel. Now at this point there are two threads in the story to follow. One is the imminent battle between Israel and the Philistines, and the other is what happened when David and his men went back to their temporary home at Ziklag. Of course, the sacred writ gives the narrative of the return to Ziklag first. But in other words, simultaneous, we could skip this chapter and go right to the next chapter about the battle against Saul, because it's happening at the same time. As David and his men now head back south on the long journey to Ziklag, you can imagine how lighthearted and full of joy David must have been. He was no doubt giving thanks to God for delivering him from the dreadful dilemma that he'd been facing. So as they're marching back to Ziklag, can't you just picture him virtually skipping along and filled with insouciance? And that's not a brand of beer. It means a carefree spirit. Insouciance. I thought I'd throw that in. I learned it this week. So over here on the map, David and the boys are leaving the area of the Valley of Jezreel here, coming down against the coast, and they got a long march all the way back past the land of the Philistines, way back down here to Ziklag. And in Hebrew usage, any part of a day is considered a day. So when it says, for example, 3 days, it could mean a 24-hour day in the middle and only part of the day before and only part of the day after. And they'd call that 3 days, or 3 days and 3 nights. So when we read now in chapter 30, verse 1, it says, "And it came to pass when David and his men were come to Ziklag on the third day." It was at least 24 hours plus part of a day before, and they're arriving on the third day. And when they got there, it says that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag and had smitten Ziklag and burned it with fire and had taken the women captives that were therein. They slew not any, either great or small, but carried them away and went on their way. Uh-oh. Frankly, I think David got off easy. You know why I say that? Remember last time when David had attacked the Amalekites? He did an ethnic cleansing, didn't he? He killed every single man, woman, and child so there wouldn't be any left to go back and tell Achish, the king, what he'd done. Because he went back and told Achish he'd been killing Judahites or Israelites in the southlands of Judah, remember? So David had done an ethnic cleansing. And here are the Amalekites. They're seeking revenge for David's slaughter of their fellow Amalekites, but chalk it up to divine providence. Again, they kill no one. Which is really strange, since the Amalekites were noted for atrocious cruelty. However, there is the possibility that they fully intended to fulfill their cruel trait by subjecting their captives to prolonged tortures before actually killing them. But by God's plan, they decided of their own alleged free will merely to seize all the property, kidnap all the women and children for now, and then torch the town. And bad as that is, somebody upstairs is looking out for David, isn't he? Verse 3. "So David and his men came to the city, and behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters were taken captives. Then David and the people that were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. And David's two wives were taken captives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, the wife of Nabal, the Carmelite." This is truly a sad spectacle. Coming home to see your entire town burned to the ground. But even though, through it all, David must have known that the women and children were probably still alive, because if the Amalekites had been intending to do an immediate tit-for-tat, he would have seen the corpses all over the town. So at this point, at least he knows they were alive when they were carried away. But where did they go? Verse 6, "And David was greatly distressed, for the people spake of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and for his daughters. But David encouraged himself in Yahweh his God." This is one of the drawbacks of being a leader. When things go well, you're a hero. Everybody loves you. But when things go badly, you get the blame for it. And if things go really bad, your followers are ready to stone you. As a prospective overcomer, David is really on a roller coaster. One day, he's the target of Saul for spear practice. The next day, he's able to sneak into the middle of Saul's wagon train and take off with Saul's scepter and his fancy water jug. We've covered all this in past messages. Then he's off, happy again, offering protection services to Nabal. And the next day, Nabal spits in his face. It's up and down like a roller coaster. Then nasty, nefarious Nabal dies, and so David takes the farmer's wife. And he's again filled with insouciance and delight. Then it's off to the land of the Philistines for over a year, where it's more of the same, culminating now in almost being forced to take up arms against his own people with Achish. And then his fat is pulled out of the fire by a marvelous divine deliverance. And so he's all happy going back home to Ziklag, and he gets home and finds his whole town is burned to the ground and all the women and children are missing. And all his men are muttering about stoning him. What does this say about David's fellow overcomer candidates? It says that they too have their own personal spiritual battle against the Philistines within. In certain desperately trying circumstances, it shows that they can be just as nasty as old Saul ever was. After all, would you rather die quickly by a spear in the chest or by being pelted with stones for a couple of hours before you die? But here's the difference between Saul and David. Saul expected the men around him to put him on a pedestal and to serve his every whim and wish. In contrast, David was a leader with a servant's heart. He wanted to serve God first and foremost, and he realized that one of the best ways to do that was to serve the people whom God had brought around him. Saul came to expect being served and being obeyed, and yet he himself would not submit to the authority of Yahweh. He wasn't obedient to God. And therefore, over the years, Saul lost his comlink with the Heavenly Father, so that when things went badly and he didn't know what to do, he turned to the witch of Endor to try to open a channel with the dead prophet Samuel. Why, he'd show God. If you won't talk to me, then I'll just have the witch of Endor here dial up the spirit of Samuel and she can channel him for me. And we know from our last message what happened then. David, on the other hand, as we know from the record of the Psalms, kept his comlink with Yahweh open at all time. Because when times were good, David praised Yahweh and gave him thanks for the wonderful, bountiful blessings. And when things went badly, he also went to Yahweh, sometimes to complain, admittedly, but also to humbly ask for the Father's guidance on what to do next. And that's the case here. They're ready to stone him. It's bad news. So he gets a hold of the Father. And no necromancy here. No witch of Endor. No communication with spirits other than the Holy Spirit of God through the means which God had provided, which is the Urim and the Thummim. Verse 7. David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, I pray thee, bring me hither the ephod. And Abiathar brought thither the ephod to David. Now, since we've discussed it in a previous message in this series, we're only going to mention it in passing here, that the ephod is a figure of speech called metonymy, where one thing is put for another. In this case, the ephod is put for the Urim and Thummim. Because if you recall, the ephod was one of the outer garments of the high priest, to which was attached the breastplate with the 12 gemstones, and then inside that was the pouch, which had the Urim and the Thummim inside. So when he says to Abiathar to bring him the ephod, he's talking about the whole works because he wants to use the Urim and the Thummim to get a hold of the Father. So, verse 8, David inquired at Yahweh, saying, Shall I pursue after this troop? Shall I overtake them? And he answered him, Pursue, for thou shalt surely overtake them, and without fail recover all. So David went, he and the 600 men that were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those that were left stayed behind. Again on the map, it's going off the map here, but down here there is a brook which runs from the mountain range. There's a mountain range that runs like this, and way down here, it starts up in the mountains and it runs way out here to the Mediterranean Sea. And of course, during the snow melt or the wet season, there's a lot of water going through there, and other times it's like the Rio Grande at some times. You can walk across, it's so shallow. They call them wadis, W-A-D-I-Y or something like that over there. But at this particular time, there must have been a lot of water going through there, because it says in verse 10, "But David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 abode behind, which were so faint that they could not go over the brook Besor." All 600 of them had just marched 2 or 3 days from way up north in the land of Issachar, so it wouldn't be surprising that some of them were pretty exhausted. So David has only 2/3 of his army left to actually do battle with who knows how many Amalekites. But there's no indication that this fact troubled David in the least, that he's only got 2/3 of the army left. Why didn't it trouble him? Because he had heard directly from the father that he would be 100% successful. The father told him he would recover everything. And so it didn't matter if he had to leave 1/3 of the army back in the staging area. After all, do you think this loss of 1/3 of the army caught Yahweh by surprise? And Yahweh was now up in heaven, wringing his hands, walking back and forth, pacing, you know, up in the golden streets up there, supposedly. And he's really anxious now, and he goes, "David, pick up the phone. Pick up the phone. Can't you hear it ringing? It's me, Dad. Please, pick up the phone. I got to talk to you again. We lost 1/3 of the army. We got to change the plan." I don't think so. Not with predestination in place. I don't think there's any chance of that scenario. Do you? So David and his men, 400 of them, proceed across the brook Besor looking for the marauders. 11. "And they found an Egyptian in the field, and he brought him to David and gave him bread, and he did eat, and they made him drink water, and they gave him a piece of a cake of figs and 2 clusters of raisins. And when he had eaten, his spirit came again to him, for he had eaten no bread nor drunk any water 3 days and 3 nights. And David said unto him, To whom belongest thou, and whence art thou? And he said, I am a young man of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite, and my master left me because 3 days ago I fell sick. We made an invasion upon the south of the Kerethites, and upon the coast which belongeth to Judah, and upon the south of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. And David said to him, Canst thou bring me down to this company? And he said, Swear unto me by God that thou wilt neither kill me nor deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will bring thee down to this company." In other words, Providence provided the intel. Weren't you in intel, Tom?
Yeah.
Providence provided the intel information so David would know where the Amalekites were. Now, the Amalekite master of this slave was utterly cruel in leaving him in the wilderness to die of thirst and starvation. And because of that cruelty of that one Amalekite, many of the Amalekites are going to perish. We notice from verse 14 that the Amalekites not only burned Ziklag, but they also raided the border of Judah and a specific area of South Judah which belonged to Caleb's descendants, and they even invaded the territory of the Kerethites, who were either Philistines or proto-Philistines, meaning the indigenous people who were there before the Philistines. Now, interestingly, just as David was entrusted with being the secret service detachment for the Philistine king Achish, the scripture later tells us that several hundred Kerethites defected over to David, and he made them his own personal bodyguards under a man named Benaiah. All right, now the Egyptian slave is leading David and his troops to the location of the Amalekites, verse 16. "And when he had brought him down, behold, they were spread abroad upon all the earth, eating and drinking and dancing, because of all the great spoil that they had taken out of the land of the Philistines and out of the land of Judah." No doubt, prior to making their raids, these Amalekites also had intel sources which had reported to them that David and his army was way up north in Jezreel, and they were going into battle against Israel up there, so that the Amalekites thought that they were totally safe from any immediate retaliation. Hence, they were celebrating, probably getting quite drunk and with no expectation whatsoever of being attacked. 17. And David smote them from the twilight even unto the evening of the next day, and there escaped not a man of them, save 400 young men which rode upon camels and fled. The way this is phrased, nobody escaped except 400. I think that kind of implies that the 400 was just a small fraction of the total group of Amalekites, right? And how many men did David attack with? 400. You might say 400 is kind of a prominent number in this passage, wouldn't you? But he might have been going up against a force four or five times or more larger than his own. And even though they attacked under cover of darkness, and even though probably the Amalekites were drunk, it still indicates that David had to possess a great faith to go ahead and proceed with the attack. But if you heard from God, what more do you need? I thought this was peculiar that the scriptures would mention the fact, not just that 400 of them escaped, but it says they escaped on camels. I don't know much about camels, and I still don't, but I did do a little bit of research in preparation for this. I found out there's basically two kinds of camels. There's the Bactrian camel, which originated in the high central plateaus of Asia, and they come in the one and the two hump variety. Then the second kind is the Arabian camel, which are also known as dromedaries. And these are all the one-humper types. But there's two types of dromedaries. One is more stout and is used for carrying burdens up to 700 weight, I read in the encyclopedia. 700 pounds, I presume that means. Boy, that's a lot of freight, isn't it? As you might expect, they can't travel too fast, about 24 miles in a day. Now, if you've been in the service, you've done some hiking. And I remember, this was after I'd been out of the service, this was only about 15 years ago, I did an all-day hike and an overnight and then hiked again, and only 9 miles, and that was pretty much pooped me out for the day. Of course, I wasn't 18 at the time either, but 24 miles in a day is still, therefore, faster than an average person walks, about three times as fast. But the other camel is a lighter one, and it's primarily used for saddling and riding, and it can cover about 200 miles in a day. So these babies can really clip along. I bet you can guess which kind of camels the 400 Amalekites were riding. Turbocharged camels, yeah. Is that the one without the filters? So once the carnage is over, it says in verse 18, and David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away. And David rescued his two wives. And there was nothing lacking to them, neither small nor great, neither sons nor daughters, neither spoil nor anything that they had taken to them. David recovered all. I think that's important. It tells us twice that David recovered everything that the Amalekites had taken, plus some additional loot to boot. 20. And David took all the flocks and the herds which they drave before those other cattle and said, this is David's spoil. The additional loot was that which was taken by the Amalekites from the Philistines and the other Judahites. So all David's men had recovered their own cattle and goods, and the rest of it they called David's spoil. As their leader, it was up to him to decide what to do with the rest of this stuff that didn't belong to his men personally. 21. And David came to the 200 men which were so faint that they could not follow David, whom they had made also to abide at the brook Besor. And they went forth to meet David and to meet the people that were with him. And when David came near to the people, he saluted them. Can you imagine the 200 guys back there at the staging location? Can you imagine the joy in their faces when they first get word or they see him coming afar off, this 400 men with all the wives and the children and all the beasts of burden bringing all this stuff back? What a wonderful reunion that must have been for those 200 men, therefore, to see their wives and families still intact also. But it didn't last long, because their joy soon turned to frowns of displeasure and then probably anger as they heard some of the men who went with David demanding that none of the spoils be given to them. 22. Then answered all the wicked men and men of Belial of those that went with David and said, because they went not with us, we will not give them aught, or won't give them anything of the spoil that we have recovered, save to every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart. Now that's a nasty attitude, isn't it? They don't even want to give back to these 200 men their own personal cattle and goods. Just give them their wives and their children, and since they didn't go with us, kick them out of here. Get them out of here. That's pretty nasty. David would have none of it. 23. Then said David, ye shall not do so, my brethren, with that which Yahweh hath given us, who hath preserved us and delivered the company that came against us into our hand. You know what leaps out at me from that verse? Sovereignty of God. Wow. In a very kind and gentle manner, notice the character mark there, because he says, my brethren, even though these guys were, it says, wicked. In a loving and gracious manner, David tells these wicked men that they don't deserve anything either. It is all by the grace of Yahweh. It was Yahweh who preserved them in battle. It was Yahweh who delivered the victory. It was Yahweh who gave them all things, their wives, their children, their herds, all the goods that had been taken. Yahweh gave it back to them. And notice, these men are called sons of Belial. They're called wicked. Are these cursed Amalekites? No, these are Israelites. They're wicked because they are selfish. But that's just the superficial reason. It goes deeper than that. Why are they selfish? Because they think they have a right to the spoils because of what they had done. But David gently corrects them. Even though they were in action, even though they were active, playing their parts in the battle, David says, it was all Yahweh's doing. God is sovereign and he gets credit for everything. That's what David was telling them. Anticipating the Apostle Paul's words in Ephesians, David was plainly trying to get his overcomer candidates to understand that it is not of their works, lest any man should boast. You see that? They were in effect boasting that they deserved the spoils because of the work of their hands. This is a mark of Saul, the work of their hands crowd. It is characteristic of many non-overcomer believers, but it is not the attitude of an overcomer. For how can a person be an overcomer and therefore be trusted to administer in loving kindness in God's kingdom when that person thinks he deserves this or that because of something he has done? David lets them know they have no cause for boasting. It is all the work of God. Can we apply that to our lives today? I should think so. Those of you who were here or on our tape ministry 5 years ago might recall how I began the 10-part series on the sovereignty of God. Do you remember I handed out a little secret ballot quiz before anything else? I don't think hardly anybody was here, were you? Was anybody here for that? Just barely, at our first meeting over at that other hotel?
I guess I was. Yeah.
Okay. The very first one. Okay. We began with a secret ballot type of quiz. It was a multiple choice question that went something like this. I believe that my salvation is brought about, A, by myself alone, B, by myself and God working together, or C, by God alone. All three of these choices or beliefs are found in Christianity today. Choice A is found primarily in the very liberal denominations. It's the belief of the humanists, who believe that man is getting better and better all the time, and someday we will attain perfection by our own works. In theological circles, this is known as Pelagianism. after a 4th century British monk called Pelagius, who taught such claptrap. Choice B is semi-humanism, or semi-Pelagianism, as it's called. It's also called Arminianism, named after the 16th century Dutch Protestant James Arminius. Billy Graham and many other modern evangelicals are Arminians because they believe that God offers you the opportunity to get saved, and God really wants you to get saved, but in the end, it's all up to your free will decision whether or not to get saved or not. Choice C is for Calvinism, named for the great reformer. He taught, as did Martin Luther, that our salvation was the work of God alone. Those who are saved are only saved because the Father draws them. And whatever we do, if we go down to the altar, quote unquote, whatever we do is simply a response to the work of the Father. If we choose to get saved, it's only because He caused us to desire to choose that way. So even in our little example here with David and the boys, even though they all were active in conquering the Amalekites and recovering their families, David reminded them it was all God's doing. Let's take a break.